2016-0076, Exxon Corporation and Exxon Texas Inc. versus Emerald Oil and Gas Company, LP, and Lori T. Meesh et al. From Refugio County and the 13th Court of Appeals District. Court is allotted 20 minutes per side in each of these arguments, and the court will take a brief recess between the arguments. We expect to conclude all arguments before noon. These proceedings are being recorded, and a link to the argument should be posted on the court's website by the end of the day today. Court is now ready to hear argument in 050835, Big Pen Corporation versus Janice Carter as next friend of Brittany Carter.
May it please the court, Mr. Simpson will present argument for the petitioner. Petitioner is reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Mr. Chief Justice Jefferson, justices of the court, may it please the court, my name is Reagan Simpson, presenting arguments for the petitioner, Big Pen Corporation. With me today is Daryl Barger, who was BIC's lead trial counsel at the trial of this case.
I want to see if we can talk about an issue I think is probably most significant to begin with, and that's this preemption doctrine. Could you, I'm sure you want to talk about that, so tell me why this is preempted under the federal statute.
This is preempted under the principles announced by the United States Supreme Court in the Guyer versus American Honda case, in which the court applied implied preemption, that a federal statute is not self-defeating, and if a state law conflicts and would frustrate the federal purposes, then the state law is impliedly preempted. In this particular case, there is a federal regulation that deals with disposable lighters promulgated under the Consumer Product Safety Act and administered by the Consumer Product Safety Commission. The commission has set forth certain requirements for disposable lighters such as the one in this case. Significantly, the federal policy is a balance of interests. One of the interests is user-friendliness, recognizing that if lighters are too hard for adults to operate, they will not be used. Instead, other alternatives will be used to light cigarettes or other things that are not that do not have child resistance.
BIC had other lighters that were more child-resistant than this lighter in question, correct?
That's a very interesting question, and I do not believe, Justice Medina, that the evidence bears that out, and that really is a fallacy in the entire causation argument that the other side presents in this case, because there is no basis for comparing tests of different lighters. This is a situation in which the causation theory is based on a small portion of an overall test not designed to show causation, and actually the results of the small portion of the test relied upon are at odds with the general test. And there is, in fact, no way to compare tests of one lighter to the other because there's no controls. There's no controls between one test and the other. In other words, there's not an assessment of psychological and motor skill analysis done of the participants. Instead, the children are selected at random between 42 and 51 months.
Do we even get to the causation issue if this whole area is preempted?
We believe that the entire area is preempted both as to design and the manufacturing claims, and it goes to the balancing of the federal interests that we want to have some child protection, but we don't want things too hard. And there's two factors that are at play here. One is the age of the child, and we have Jonas Carter, who's above the age, and the other is the difficulty of operating the ladder.
And that's an argument I know that you make, that is that when the federal standard is carefully set to balance these interests, that it really, it's not a minimum standard. It's just, it's something the feds have struck, and if you require anything more, then you're conflicting with the purpose of that standard. But then how do you square the savings clause with that?
The savings clause, as discussed in the Guyer case, there's two aspects in 15 U.S.C. 2074, which is the savings clause, and 2075, which is the preemption clause. And what the U.S. Supreme Court has held is a savings clause indicates that some common law actions are not preempted And that leads to implied preemption. You have to look at the particular product that's at issue, the particular regulations, determine what the purpose of those is, and determine whether or not the state law impliedly then preempts or frustrates the federal goals. And you have to do, and I think it's good to keep in mind that the savings clause is a general savings clause, and there are a lot of products that are being regulated. In some situations, you have minimum standards. In some situations, you do not. So you always have to look at the particular product.
So if you say this is a situation where you don't have a minimum standard, that the savings clause doesn't really revive the claim, it doesn't set it as a floor.
That's right.
Then what do you do about the manufacturing defect claim? Because I don't see how that is any sort of balancing of competing interests.
There are several things. First of all, I think that in this case, the manufacturing defect claim is essentially the same thing as a design defect, because the only purpose for the manufacturing specifications is child resistance. So we're really talking about the same thing. The second thing is
my understanding is their manufacturing claim is that even with the federal standard, even the 85%, the way it was manufactured, the controls didn't even meet that standard. And so that would not be the same claim.
Well, one thing that remains the same is that if you enforce the manufacturing defect claim in this case, you're still enforcing it for Jonas with respect to Jonas Carter, who is someone who is beyond the age that is thought to be protected by the federal claim. So that is a problem that is still there for preemption on their standpoint. I submit, too, that the manufacturing specifications are part of the submission to the Consumer Product Safety Commission. So when you send in the report, like Plaintiff's Exhibit 55C and 55E, which are the two ones at issue in this case, it lists the specifications, it lists the performance tests, and the CPSC then approves the lighter, or the lighter is in compliance. So it's not just the performance, but it's also the specifications.
What claims are not preempted? What claims would the savings clause save?
For instance, I've got a big lighter in my hand, I'm not doing anything with it, and it blows up. It falls apart. I can say this lighter is made in compliance. It passed the test and all that, but that would have nothing to do with the fact that it just simply fell apart in my hands and blew up. That would be an example, and that's why you have to look at the particular claims that are being made to see whether vindicating those claims and upholding those claims would, in fact, frustrate federal policies. And the plaintiffs, and we showed on, I think, in pages 24 through 26 and page 30 of our opening brief, the arguments that were made in the trial court below that, well, there ought to be, every child ought to be protected. 2 out of 100 ought to be protected instead of 10 out of 100. Those kind of arguments are made squarely in the face and a frontal assault on the balancing interests that the federal government has struck, realizing that there's two competing interests here that need to be balanced.
You talked a couple of times about this child's age, and it's certainly highlighted in brief, and if I recall correctly, it was 2 months older than the guidelines. And you said you look at these claims individually. Do you take that in consideration as well, or is it just a bright line test? If you're 5 years old and we meet the standards, it doesn't matter what your mental faculties are.
In every regulation, you have bright line tests, and we submit that it's a bright line test in this case. The children who are tested are between 42 and 51 months of age. Jonas Carter was 62 months of age at the time of this event. So he is beyond the group of children who are aimed at in this regulation for protection, and therefore allowing this claim to stand violates that federal principle. Let me talk about causation a minute, because that's another reason for reversing and rendering. I think there's preemption, causation, the interesting question of whether Havner analysis applies in this case. I don't think it does, because Havner analysis deals with the issue of chance and eliminating chance from the causal equation, and we don't have a chance issue in this case.
Just before you go to causation, just one more question on preemption.
Sure.
And assume that we agree with respondents that there is and should be a presumption against preemption of these sorts of claims, particularly where there's no express preemption, that the court has an obligation, state courts have an obligation to remain open to the claims of this sort. What is your, presuming there is a presumption against preemption, what is the strongest case? Is it Geier? Geier is your strongest case for us saying it's preempted here.
Geier is certainly the pronouncement of the United States Supreme Court that would be applicable, and very similar issues in Geier where you dealt with balancing of interests, whether people wanted to use seat belts, whether there were safety issues.
In Great Dane, we said that, you know, the presumption against preemption is nowhere stronger than when a state exercises its authority regarding health and safety.
Well, regardless of how strong the presumption is, Mr. Chief Justice, in this case, there is very carefully thought out federal policy that balances these interests. And if you look under the regulations and the comments that were made by the agency, a lot of debate on where to set the acceptance criterion and should we use a 90% acceptance criterion. They decided not to because there were safety concerns about putting the bar too high. And if you allowed states to have in different jurisdictions to, as in this case, argue that a 98% standard is a good standard, then that is going to frustrate the federal objectives, and so for that reason it should be preempted. Turning to the causation argument, in this case, the whole causation issue depends upon extrapolating from surrogate number 5 in the 1994 test, a subpart of a test involving only 16 children. When the CPSC...
That was not clear. Was that a test that BIC conducted or that was conducted for this case?
It was conducted by the Milford Consulting Company, I believe, Justice Hecht, who had been retained by BIC to do the testing. It's not a testing by the federal government. It's a testing by a contractor at the request of BIC.
But was it testing at the time the LIDAR was made?
It was testing that was done in October of 1994 and reported on in the Exhibit 55C, which I think was early 95 or maybe late 94.
It was the testing that BIC used to pass the federal protocol.
It was a testing that BIC was required to engage in order to have its products approved. It's very detailed regulations. It says exactly what the tester is supposed to do, what children are to be selected in terms of their age groups. It's very detailed in the regulations.
The confusing part to me was there were apparently 5 surrogates.
That's correct.
And
6.
Okay, 6 surrogates. And there's an average taken of those 6 surrogates. And if the average meets the protocol, BIC says it's okay.
Well,
and the problem that the Court of Appeals had and the theory that the plaintiff had at the trial court was that one of the surrogates was clearly out of compliance, and that by using a surrogate that was clearly out of compliance, and I understand you dispute the basis for the out of compliance, but presume that that were a valid basis, that by skewing it that way, by having such a wide variable among the surrogates, that ended up in spirit kind of violating the federal protocol because you would end up with a lot of LIDARs that would be the same as non-child resistant.
Well, the use of surrogates and the number of surrogates is regulated by the CPSC, and that's required to be done. And in fact, what the testimony is, that BIC tends to use surrogates at the lower end so that really promotes safety because then you manufacture it a little higher. You have a target a little bit higher than that, so you'd rather test something at the low end than rather than at the top end. So I don't really understand the Court of Appeals discussion of wide variance. The reason that surrogate 5 is not relevant, though, is because it's a subtest of only 16 children. And there is nothing to show whether the 6 who could light surrogate 5 could also have operated the touted J-15, the J-25, the J-16, these other lighters. There's nothing to show because it's not statistically significant. In fact, the CPSC itself rejected tests with only 50 children. So if it rejected 50 children as a basis for making any regulations and any statements about lighters, then it certainly is going to reject extrapolation of data from only 16 children. The same thing goes true with comparing the lighters because there's no control group. There's no way to tell whether the same kinds of children tested the J-16 as opposed to the J-26. And it's also clear that there are testing variations. Sometimes the modified J-26 will be 90%. Sometimes it's 96%. There is no way that you can make statistically significant choices and analyses of the various tests. It's simply a regulatory test that BIC complies with, and it cannot be used as a basis for causation.
Well, let me ask you this. The Court of Appeals said, at trial, the plaintiff argued that BIC deliberately inserted lower-performing surrogates, such as surrogate 5, into groups of lighters with better performances, such as the three surrogates which no child could operate during the testing of the J-26. And this allowed BIC to meet the Commission's protocol while still manufacturing lighters that were only marginally, if at all, safer than non-child-resistant lighters. I understand you contest the factual support for that. But if that were the way that a company were meeting the federal protocol, by having very low surrogates that clearly did not meet the standard, balancing that out with absolutely 100% child resistant, that at least the spirit of the protocol would be violated.
Well, I don't believe so, because again, if you set the surrogates at a low value and then manufacture something above that, then you've got sort of a safety margin, and that's the testimony that's
been
given.
But how would you know if you manufactured above that if you destroyed the manufacturing specifications?
Well, at the time you manufacture, you have the specifications available. The exfoliation issue comes on only, in this case, years later in trying to deal with the evidence in this case. But at the time, there's certain internal targets, maximum and minimums, that they manufacture to. And if you have surrogates that are at the lower end and they all pass in the overall test, then you know if you're manufacturing a little higher than that, you're certainly staying within the bounds.
But we don't know that in this case, because there's no evidence.
And I also point out, Justice O'Neill, that there is no argument, even by the opposing experts, that there was any failure. And I think this is at volume 766 and 136. There's no argument that BIC did not follow the protocol. There's some complaint about the nature of the protocol and what it might allow people to do. But I hardly think that that's a basis for liability when the protocol has been followed. I see that my time is up, and I'll reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you, Counselor. The court is now ready to hear argument from the respondents.
May it please the court, Ms. Powell will present argument for the respondent.
Good morning. My name is Lisa Powell. I'm here today on behalf of Brittany Carter. Along with me are Daniel Gerwitz, Dan Worthington, and Dan Schindler. The court has indicated an interest in the preemption argument, so I would like to begin with that today. We do not believe that any of the claims asserted by the plaintiffs in this case are preempted. First of all, although the existence of a savings clause may not be dispositive, it is certainly important to the analysis, because this court's primary purpose, of course, is to discern the intent of Congress. And when Congress includes an express savings clause in a statute,
which they frequently do,
that is true. But in this case, you also have a savings clause along with one that has only a minimum standard. If you take a look at the particular standards, and I know that there's been some argument over this, but the particular standards involved in this statute, unlike a number of other statutes that are addressed in the cases cited by BIC, this standard is clearly a minimum standard. The requirement in Section 1210.3 indicates that disposable lighters shall be resistant to successful operation by at least 85% of the child test panel. That type of language is very similar to the language evaluated by this court in the Great Dane case. In the Great Dane case, there was a motor vehicle safety standard that required that the trailer manufacturers include at least, again the same number, at least a certain number of reflective panels on these trailers. This court, in looking at that case and looking at preemption, noted that that was a minimum standard and that a state common law requirement required...
Well, but there's a big difference there, because in that case, putting additional lights isn't going to hurt anything, but in this case, the federal government balanced the interest of not making it too hard to light so people then wouldn't use matches, which would be more dangerous. So there was a competing safety concern that favored the more user-friendly side, causing the minimum standard to come down.
We disagree that that is a factor in this case for a couple of reasons. First of all, I think if you look at the actual language in the regulations, the primary concern was more whether or not it was technologically feasible to go above 85%. BIC has clearly demonstrated that it can. But in addition, the primary
purpose... Sure, I can go to 100%. I can make a lighter with no fluid in it. And the kids will never be able to burn themselves up in it. But I won't sell many, right?
It wouldn't be a lighter than a lighter.
But BIC itself has evaluated the efficacy of this lighter. We're not talking about some pie-in-the-sky safety device that we're suggesting that BIC ought to try out. We are talking about lighters that BIC actually sent through the process, were approved by the government, and sold by BIC.
At what percent, then, should they have been manufactured? Should they have tested the ones they sell?
It is our position that if BIC has demonstrated that it can manufacture lighters to 97 and 98% child resistance, that is the standard that BIC, that should be enforced in this case, both on the design defect.
Let me press you on that. If it's 90, let's say 98%, then if your client is in the tube, then it's not defective. There is no design defect. If it's 98% safe with kids under five.
Yes.
And so if your client is one of the people, the 2%, then as a matter of law, they must lose, even though they burnt themselves or their sister or the case may be.
Well, assuming that there's no manufacturing, we would agree that we would not have a design defect claim if the lighter was protective to that level.
So
there might be a manufacturing defect claim or some other type of claim.
But that's a matter of law occurrence because you say 98% is safe, then the other 2% are just out of luck, and I'm wondering what makes you more authoritative or the jury more authoritative than the CPSC?
Well, I believe that the CPSC clearly indicated that this was a minimum criteria, and they indicated a desire to look at the common law when you take a look at the savings clause, because the savings clause indicates that this chapter shall not relieve any person from liability at common law. Now, obviously, we can't force BIC into and do not claim a design defect beyond what is technologically feasible. But again, BIC has demonstrated the feasibility of this. This is not some esoteric safety design. This is a design that BIC tested, that the federal government approved. It's a little difficult for BIC to argue that the J-15 and J-25 are somehow contrary to the federal government's purposes when the federal government approved those lighters and BIC sold those lighters. BIC made money off of those lighters. Our argument is merely that if you have a choice between leaving 10 children of 100 at risk or leaving 2 children of 100 at risk, if the technology's there, you ought to go with saving as many children as possible.
Well, of course,
and we think that's entirely
because you represent the kid. But neither you nor the CPC is in the business of selling these things, right? I mean, we've got to balance utility. That's a fact. On product liability, we've got to balance utility.
That's true. BIC balance the utility.
Which CPSC doesn't necessarily need to do. They don't care whether the sales or not, do they?
Well, first of all, again, I think the standard's clearly a minimum standard. Besides which, BIC balanced utility, and BIC marketed the J-15 and the J-25. Again, we're not talking about something that might or might not work. We're talking about a product that the federal government approved and that BIC marketed. And the choice here is, do you or do you not protect the extra 7 or 8 kids out of 100? It's our argument that those children ought to be protected and that is fully consistent with the CPS purposes when the CPSC has stated merely that the standard should be at least 85%, and when the CPSC in the preliminary analysis indicates that the standard below will increase the minimum allowable child resistance of lighters to 85%.
And your argument is premised on the fact that BIC had already demonstrated that there was a safer alternative, correct? And that's some theory that perhaps your expert came up
that's
with
correct.
That it had been designed differently.
That's correct. Now, BIC wants to challenge the efficacy of the child safety test. We believe that those are something that the jury could look at. After all, these are the tests that BIC relies upon in order to market its cigarettes. In addition, the CPSC has indicated that it believes in the efficacy of the test. The federal regulations state that the commission concludes that the results of the child panel test, which again are very strictly controlled by the regulations, but the commission concludes that the results of the child panel test provide a reasonable approximation of the ability of children to operate lighters in the home, which in turn should be directly reflected in the incidence of fire started by children with lighters.
If you can make a lighter so that 98 children out of any given 100, some given 100, can't operate it, why shouldn't you still make one where 99 or 995 out of 1,000?
Well, if the plaintiffs could have proven that such a lighter existed, then perhaps you should have.
Surely it's possible to make a lighter.
But the evidence at trial is that there are lighters that will project to 97 and 98%. The plaintiff's argument is merely that those lighters exist and they should have been marketed here rather than the J-26.
Do you think that the federal concern is valid that the harder you make it to operate for children, the harder you make it to operate for adults, and therefore adults won't use it, they'll use something else, and that will result in more fires? So there needs to be some balancing somewhere, or do you not agree, or do you don't think that's valid?
Well, that is obviously a concern, one of the concerns that the federal government had along with technological feasibility.
But I mean, do you think that's a valid concern?
No, I do not think that is a valid concern based upon the evidence here. BIC raised the issue with regard to the J-15, and BIC's arguments in that did go to the J-15 and not the J-25. But even with the J-15, there was no indication of any increase in any match fires or anything.
But they wouldn't have to prove that. I mean, I would think that you'd look at the what the federal government looked at in setting these standards. And if one of the purposes of setting it at 85 was they saw that problem out there, it seems to me like we have to rely on that federal concern.
But
them having to prove, I don't think you'd ever prove that more matches were used, that would be an impossible.
I believe that the CPSC actually concluded, however, that the vast bulk of child safety fires were started with lighters. And I don't think if you look at I believe that the federal government's primary concern was with the feasibility. Even with regard to the possibility for switching, the only evidence or the only question that BIC had was with the J-15, and even with that lighter, there wasn't any indication of any increase in other types of match fires. And BIC's arguments didn't go to the J-25, which, again, was simply a smaller version of the J-26, which is the subject lighter at issue.
Well, let's move to the manufacturing defect claim. I mean, if we're bound by the federal government's policy determination that if you try to get it up over 85, it might affect safety on the other end, if we have to accept that, how do you get to the manufacturing defect claim? Why is that not preempted?
Well, the plaintiffs had two theories for manufacturing defect. The first theory was that the lighter at question was simply below even the CPSC standards. The second theory was that BIC was
As manufactured, not as designed.
As manufactured. The second theory that the plaintiffs had was that BIC was free to and did in fact adopt higher internal manufacturing specifications. Of course, a manufacturing defect claim is a deviation from the producer's own internal specifications. So there are two theories there. Let me examine the first one first. We believe that the data shows, BIC's own test, that even if you assume that BIC's manufacturing specifications were at the very bottom of the CPSC standard, which we don't think was correct, but even if you assume that, the subject lighter was below specification on fork force, and furthermore, for two-thirds of a rotation, enough to light the lighter twice, Jonas would never have encountered a spark wheel force, which is one of the key characteristics, above 2.3, which was BIC's minimum for the spark wheel force in the criteria that they submitted to the CPSC.
But the evidence of manufacturing defect is the lighter itself, nothing other than that.
Well, that is certainly very a strong part of the evidence, but we would disagree that other evidence is not relevant. For example, Biggs destroyed evidence.
I'm asking whether there was any other evidence other than the lighter itself that there was a manufacturing defect.
No, given that BIC destroyed its manufacturing specifications and the other data that would have existed at the time, the only evidence here
before
us.
What do we do with Ridgway then? I mean, if your truck blows up, we said you can't just say that's a product defect unless you were simply driving out of, it was so close to the time of purchase that you're just driving out of the car dealer's lot and it blows up, okay, maybe we'll presume it's a product defect. But if you've driven it 50,000 miles, you can't presume the product's defective because the truck burns up. Why can we presume in this case from the fact that the lighter, after the fact, we check it and it looks defective, that was some evidence of that it was the same when it left the manufacturing plant?
Well, first of all, I think that Ridgway involved an expert who said he merely suspected that the electrical system was the cause of the fire. But here, I don't think that there's been any argument that the lighter was in some fashion modified by Janice. I don't know how she would go about doing that.
It was used.
Well, that's true, but the lighter is supposed to protect children. That's its function. A seatbelt in a car is supposed to protect the occupants, even if this car has been driven for 10,000 miles. The purpose of the child resistance, a lighter is going to be used, and the purpose of the child resistance criteria is to protect children. And there's no indication here of any abuse or anything of the sort. That's never been argued.
You're missing my point. They don't have to prove that there was no manufacturing defect. You have to prove there was. And your proof of that is look at the lighter.
Yes. And if you look at the lighter, even if you assume that BIC's manufacturing criteria were at the low end, this lighter deviates. More importantly, we don't know what BIC's manufacturing specifications were because BIC, after the suit was filed and after it received a document production request, destroyed the data that would have showed what those manufacturing specifications were. We believe, and the trial judge agreed, that the jury was therefore entitled to assume that BIC's actual manufacturing specifications were at the high end, at least of the CPSC specifications. That is consistent with what BIC initially testified. Again, BIC's view of its manufacturing specifications was a moving target throughout trial. BIC's expert initially testified, gave specifications that were identical to those in 55C, which is the only lighter certification test for this particular type of J26. Now, after BIC tested the lighter, and bear in mind that it's BIC's position that the lighter can only be tested on a very particular sophisticated Instron machine, and then only with BIC's proprietary fixtures, which exist only at BIC and possibly the CPSC. So plaintiffs can't go out and get this tested just anywhere. Basically, BIC's position is you got to have BIC do it. After BIC did its own test and got the results, BIC then wants to say, well, we think we're going to change our mind here. We really think these specifications over here were our manufacturing specifications, and furthermore, you can't evaluate it because we tested it the wrong way. But if you assume that the manufacturing specifications are at the top of the CPSC specifications, which we think is reasonable, then this lighter tested low on every single one of the force criteria. Not only low, but some 40% low. The testimony is that that is unreasonably dangerous. We believe that the jury could reasonably conclude from that evidence that there was a manufacturing defect in this particular lighter.
What if Jonas had been 8?
Well, it is the plaintiff's theory that what is important here, first of all, he wasn't 8, but what's important here is his developmental age. Here he was only two months above the federal government's cutoff, and the independent evidence was that he was operating some two and a half years below his chronological age. He had attention deficit disorder, hyperactivity, difficulty with fine motor skills, all of which would put him in the age range that would have been covered by these tests.
And what if you have someone who is 40 and infirm in some way. And the argument's made that they have some infirmity. Or someone who's 85 in a nursing home who has some infirmity. Do we then put them within the child safety standards? I mean, does this become a factual dispute about infirmity, or is the 5 years supposed to be a bright line federal standard?
That's an issue, I think, that's not before the court. But I think that the key critical issue here is developmental age. I don't know that you could ever show that the 80-year-old was substantively the same as a you know, 3-year-old. But the evidence here is that Jonas, while he was 2 months above the criteria, was tested. And again, these were independent tests not done in conjunction with this litigation. It was done in conjunction with the schoolwork. The independent test showed that he was operating some two and a half years below his chronological age. Our point is merely that had BIC, even evaluating it for five-year-olds, had BIC met the standard for five-year-olds, Jonas would also have been protected.
And you argue that on these facts, the test really should be, the standard really should be child-proof and not really child-resistant.
No, Your Honor. We are arguing with regard to the design defect claim that it's demonstrated that BIC can manufacture lighters to 97 and 98% child resistance, and that BIC ought to be required to do so and should be liable for not doing so.
Would there be sort of a perverse disincentive here? I mean, if you say that the better they can make them, they're going to be held to the higher standard, then isn't there sort of an incentive not to try to make them better?
And the alternative, if you want to imply that type of reaction, the alternative, I think, would be the reverse incentive, where BIC's incentive, like they're trying to do here, is just to say, well, gee whiz, although we told the federal government that this lighter was 97 and 98% child resistant, as long as we can skimp by and find some interpretation of what we now think is our standard, that it meets the 85%, we're okay. That allows for a dumbing down of the standard with a minimum, with a floor of 85%, but I don't think that's what the government wanted, and I don't think that's good policy.
Ms. Powell, real quickly, turning really fast to punitives. I mean, how does compliance with the federal standard not defeat kind of the malice necessary to justify punitive?
Well, first of all, it's our argument that they did not comply with the federal standard. But in addition, you have the situation here where BIC intentionally chose to operate to sell a lighter that it knew had less child resistance. It furthermore did so with what we believe with very cavalier attitude towards the actual testing of its products. Again, I think the evidence in the brief is that BIC automatically tests things to show that the lighter's pretty and it operates. It doesn't bother with any of these automatic testing on child resistance features. The combination of all of that, we believe, is sufficient. Thank you.
But just tell me again real quick, why do you say it doesn't comply with the federal standard? I thought everybody agreed it met the 85%.
It's
only by breaking it down into surrogates that you say it doesn't meet?
It is our argument that if the design, and again, let me differentiate that between design and manufacturing. If you have a design that allows, for example, the spark wheel to go for two-thirds of a rotation without meeting the 2.3 pounds, which is what they specified to the federal government, that in effect is not meeting the CPSC requirements. And in addition, we're talking about the manufacturing defect where we're also arguing that it's below the specifications. Thank
you. Ms. Powell, you mentioned when you started that the claims that your client pursued, none of them, in your opinion, are preempted by the Act. Are there any claims, in your opinion, that the Act preempts?
The Act is certainly directed by its terms. If you look at the language of the Act and its reference to regulations, it's aimed at state statutes and state regulations, and I think that's consistent with the U.S. Supreme Court's analysis in the Sprietzma case. So certainly the Act would preempt the state of Texas, for example, from passing a law that required a different standard or from some administrative agency from doing so. But the Act, looking at the terminology used, does not preempt common law claims. The purpose of the common law is just this type of case to provide remedies for people who are injured, and we believe that that is not preempted.
So if the state of Texas codified the claims that your client's pursuing, you believe they would be preempted?
I think that there would be at least a stronger argument in that case. But again, we're talking about common law, and the U.S. Supreme Court has itself, along with this court, drawn a distinction between common law claims and statutory claims. Thank you.
You mentioned three reasons to reverse and render. One was preemption, two was causation, and three, we cut you off before you told us about it.
There's actually four. Three is Havner analysis doesn't apply because Havner in epidemiology is designed to eliminate chance from the causal equation. I washed my car, it rains, is there a causal connection? And causal connection and chance is not at issue here. The issue is the capabilities of the young boy and the features of the latter. The fourth is a very interesting topic of an unreasonable danger. And there's some different legal standards to talk about there. In the design defect by statute, it's risk utility. And we've talked about the federal policy on risk utility and weighing that. On the manufacturing defect, as submitted in the charge, the unreasonable danger is consumer expectancy. As Justice Heck mentioned in the Hernandez versus Tokai case, consumer expectancy is that lighters are going to light. They're going to create a flame. So it's a different standard of unreasonable danger, and we submit in this case that there is no basis for upholding liability on the unreasonable danger tenet because this is a lighter that met the federal standard, the 85% standard, and the subject lighter itself met the specifications it was tested for. The only specifications it was tested for, it met, and there is no evidence about what would have happened if it had been tested for the 95 specifications because the testing was different both as to force and to spark wheel rotation force. So for those reasons. Now, it should be reversed and rendered.
I'm just confused.
Sure.
How do we know that it met the 94 specifications?
Well, it was submitted. They did the testing, and it's in PX55C. Is a submission of here's the testing we did it in compliance, and it's 90%, and therefore it meets the standard.
And we have those records.
We have those records.
What records were destroyed that we can't figure out what the standard is?
The only records destroyed deal with production testing in the 42nd week of 1997, which we say are irrelevant because it doesn't matter what other lighters were tested at and what the other testing shows in other lighters because we're talking about this particular lighter in this case.
What would there be a policy, a document, a retention policy that destroys documents that are questioned during litigation? I mean, for your client to make that determination on what's relevant and not relevant, that seems to that bothers me quite a bit.
I understand, Justice Medina. The standard by the CPSC was 3 years. There's a little confusion in the testimony. There's an overall standard, PX10, which is less than 3 years, but then a specific standard in the CPSC, which was PX15. These documents were destroyed more than 3 years after the event. The question is whether or not BIC was on notice of a manufacturing defect claim. Our position on the spoliation is that the documents destroyed would not have shown anything. There's other documents that show manufacturing specifications, and what other production tests would have done doesn't make any difference. Let me direct the court's attention.
Well, how would you know? How does anybody know? Who's making that determination other than one side?
I'm not sure I understand your question. As far as
you said it wouldn't make any difference. Obviously, the other side thought it would have made a difference. The judge thought it would have made a difference. Else, perhaps there wouldn't have been this charge to the jury.
I understand, Justice Medina. Our position is that the production testing on other lighters doesn't make any difference when you have the lighter in question available for testing. So every lighter could have failed in the 42nd week of 1997. What you look at, since we have available to us the subject lighter, it can be tested. It should have been tested by the other side if they wanted to pursue this claim and try to prove causation, but they didn't. Let me, in closing, mention two exhibits. Plaintiff's Exhibit 55E, which is one of the tests of the much vaunted J26 with the two-piece hood and square wire spark wheel, vaunted by the Court of Appeals as an alternative, safer alternative design. The testing on that was 90%. DX189 is another test of the same lighter with the two-piece hood and the square-piece spark wheel, 96%. The testing is variant. So if you take the argument that it should be 96%, well, which is the J-26? Is it 90 or 96? Is it legal or is it not legal? The whole argument the other side makes puts too much into what the testing is. The testing is for regulatory purposes to achieve federal goals. It's not to prove causation. It's not controlled. It doesn't show causation. And for that reason, the court should reverse and render.
Counsel, remind me one more time. The question came up earlier. Even if this had been 98%, how do we know this young man, how do we know this fire would, this accident would not have happened?
That's always
to this particular person and this particular event.
That's always the question, Justice Johnson, because Jonas Carter may have been within the 15% that the federal government assumes can always operate any ladder.
Remind me of the evidence in the record that goes to that issue.
The evidence in the record.
One way or the other.
I'm sorry, the evidence in the record as far as the 15%? Or
that this accident would have happened regardless of what the standard was.
Well, I don't know that the evidence
that
shows that.
The accident would not have happened.
What it is there's no evidence, there's no testimony by any expert, there's no direct testimony that this accident would not have happened if you'd had slightly higher spark wheel forces or slightly higher force, because no expert was able to say that Jonas Carter would not have been able to operate the ladder with those additional forces.
There is no evidence.
There is no
your
evidence.
Position.
Any further questions?
The call is submitted, and the court will now take a brief recess.